Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Here's John Williams.
This is John Williams. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. I'll be here until 3 o'clock. We're here on Saturdays.
Lord have mercy.
10 in the morning until 12 noon on social media on WGN King John. We posted lots of pictures last night on all of our social media sites from the Bulls game. Thank you, David Hochberg and the gang at Team Hochberg, for giving us their whole center court suite with food and beverage and a bunch of WGN radio listeners who were randomly selected from my Facebook page. We said like or share this. A lot of you did, and Elif randomly selected a half dozen or so of you, and a half dozen winners, so about 12 people were able to join us in the suite. We had a terrific time. Thank you, Mr. Hochberg, for that, too. Did you guys hear the audio? You know that Chicago did not win Amazon's HQ2. It's going to go to two other locations, one outside of Washington, D.C., one in New York. Like, that's even a fair fight. Doesn't that sound like, well, of course, that's where you're going to go?
Yeah.
I mean, it is a fair fight, and if it was judged on its merit, I think Chicago, good grief, would or could win. You ask the next round of employees at Amazon, do you want to work here or there? And we would win that every time. Okay, so off they go to New York, off they go to Virginia, and that's fine.
Doesn't sound fine to you, John.
And then this happens. This is the audio. You have this Siri audio from Amazon?
Hello, Chicago. Sorry about the HQ2 rejection. But if it's any consolation, you were the second city we chose. Get it? It's funny because one of your nicknames is the second city, and that's also the name of the comedy institution in your city. Ha 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 ha. Comedy. Speaking of comedy, that's why we didn't go with you. We were intimidated by your comedic prowess. Improv, sketch, stand-up. You're too funny, Chicago. We can't match that wit and spot on delivery. Well, the delivery thing we can do. More comedy. Ha 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 ha. Being this funny is just exhausting. That's why, although you are the Windy City, we couldn't make you the W-I-N-D City. Sorry for that one. Even with the cognitive computational power of our servers, that joke was the best we could do. We'll just leave you with this. Knock knock.
Who's there?
We are.
We are who?
We are sorry, Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, adding insult to injury.
So my
I don't think that was a good apology.
I think that was the real Siri voice. But
No, I'm saying it wasn't a good apology. I believe it's real. I'm just saying.
No, it wasn't. Well, but my belief is, here's what I read.
Not Siri, though. It's not Siri.
That was produced by an ad agency in Austin, Texas, for each of the cities that didn't get it that were in the finals. This is about 18 of us. But when you listen to it, and I don't know if that came through on the radio, but when you listen to it on your computer or however you'll listen to it at home, it sounded like the Siri voice.
No, you mean
or
Alexa.
Alexa,
yeah, right.
Pardon me, Alexa. So I'm like, I don't think that's very funny. I don't think it's very smart.
I'm confused what you're saying. This was actually released through the Alexa through Amazon, or are you saying it's not?
I'm saying it was released by an ad agency in Austin, Texas.
Can I just warn you all not to say the A name because it interferes with people's listening?
That's right. Every time we use that, then suddenly it starts to go, it does whatever we say next.
Okay, so that wasn't a real apology from Amazon.
I don't know. I don't think so. I don't know.
But if they
got the voice of
they gave it. It's on Amazon, so clearly they approved it.
That is a terrible mess. That is bad corporate think.
Hey, ad agency in Texas.
There you are.
What does the average Texas student get on his SAT? Answer: drool. I'll pause for laughter.
See, how does that feel?
Hey, Chicago's loss is Amazon's loss too. Ya doofs.
Ya doofs. I mean, that was funny what they came up with. and having the Alexa voice do that. Oops, sorry, Elif. Is funny, but I don't think it's a good idea. I don't think that's a good idea. Does that make you more inclined, less inclined, not inclined at all to patronize Amazon services? Whatever.
Well, here's the thing. I think maybe it was a bit of a backhanded compliment. They're telling us we're funny, and they're trying to, you know, cheer us up a little bit there.
Yeah. Well, it was a backhanded compliment. Yeah.
Well, I wonder if the other cities that didn't, did everyone get quote unquote second place? Or
right.
Are we actually second?
No, that's a good point. I mean, yeah, we're the second city. That pun works. But they had to write different copy for the other 17 because...
So do they tell them, you're number 17?
No, I think they said you were number 2 also.
Everyone got number 2? That's even worse.
Well, it's a participation trophy. It's all of those that were in the finals but didn't win are tied for second.
That's not right. Well, rank us. Tell us exactly what you think about us.
Well, no, because you're the first or second in this race, and second loses. So
you kind of relax a little bit when you're like, well, we didn't get it, but we were second.
I would almost rather be 17th than second.
No, that's a stretch.
No, so, really. I mean, really, you want to be that close and just miss it? You won't sleep at night. But if you're 17th place, you go, whatever, we weren't even in it.
If they really wanted to be funny, they would say we didn't get the headquarters, but we did win the 2016 Winter or Summer Olympics.
Yeah, and then, but we didn't.
No, I know.
And then say, correction, never win.
Well, that's how this feels. I'm sorry. There's no consolation or solace in their snark.
You know, maybe we don't want these people here.
You know what? That's it.
I'm serious. You know, we're good. We're good.
We'll be fine without you. We don't need your stupid delivery service anyway.
You know, we wanted it badly.
We really
we didn't get it. And they may or may not have played the whole country, but it's over. We didn't get it.
We would have given them anything for it. Desperate for it. They could have had the post office.
Well, that's the problem. We need to be less desperate when trying to get these things. Maybe that's what they're looking for.
Hey, do you guys think that Trumpy Bear ad is for real? Speaking of things that are or are not legit, I know The Rope played this briefly at 5 o'clock yesterday, but there's a 2-minute-long ad that...
Infomercial style.
Right, and a version of it ran on Fox. And why not? Because it's a teddy bear that looks like Donald Trump. It has orange hair. It's a teddy bear with orange hair, and it's wearing a business suit with a long red tie. Okay, so there's your Trumpy Bear, right? And the ad online goes 2 minutes. I don't know how long the ad ran that ran on Fox News. But it starts with images of America and flag and a grizzly bear, right? And then from there it segues to this bear and people endorsing it. The bear on a flagpole with its backpack flag sticking out. Or, the bear on a mantelpiece with candles next to the medals that a veteran has won, so that you honor the veteran by placing the Trumpy Bear next to them. Anyway, the ad sounds a little like this.
The wind whispered through the forest. A storm is coming. You cannot defeat the storm. From the trees rose a resounding voice. I fear nothing. I come when the trumpet sounds. I am the storm, the great American grizzly. Introducing the original Trumpy Bear, the fearless, super plush American grizzly. Trumpy Bear was born June 14th, Flag Day. Just find the secret zipper and pull out the flag blanket. Then wrap yourself in the red, white, and blue for comfort and warmth. Show your patriotism and proudly display Trumpy on Flag Day.
So it goes like that for 2 minutes. I think that thing's for real. So I think that the marketing behind that is to super patriots and super Trump lovers. And Lord knows there's millions of them out there. They're going to get this at Christmas. They're going to get and give this at Christmas. Elif was thinking about buying it, but more as a gag gift, like the white elephant. You can get it for just two $19.95 payments plus shipping and handling. So figure you're out $50 for this.
Which is pretty expensive.
That's what she said. I don't think that's expensive.
Normally the infomercials are two small payments or, you know, there's normally it's $19.99 and then you get something extra.
I think say $50-$60 is what this is going to cost. If you're one of those people wearing the red hats, this is a small price to pay for. And by the way, it also comes with, I'm not making this up, a certificate of authenticity. I don't even know what is authenticating. It's a toy that you got in the mail. But anyway, it comes with a certificate of authenticity. The Trumpy Bear. Just think about that for a minute. I mean, I'm going to start issuing certificates of authenticity. Randomly hand them out to strangers. Here's a certificate of authenticity. I just said hello.
It could be a great Christmas gift.
In fact, I'm just going to give the certificate and save myself $60.
Forget about the calendars. Certificates of authenticity.
Hey,
you just met Steve Bertrand.
I'm the guy that bought the summit coin. I'm the guy that bought the North Korea USA summit coin.
Definitely are.
I was showing that to Elephant Violetta in the office.
Before there was a summit.
In fact, the date on it is wrong because they rushed the coins out before they even knew if they could meet Kim Jong-un, and they couldn't.
You know why they did that?
No.
Because they knew there'd be people who'd buy them.
Well, they got about $60-$70 for me. I think I may have paid $100 for that. It was,
bought more than one.
I thought, what value? Patriotism. Yeah, and I did buy two sets, one for my family and one to give to a trusted loved one.
I know I got nervous today in the office. I wasn't wearing gloves when I was handling it.
And by the way, if you just joined us, she's talking about a coin.
Well, so, thank you.
So anyway, is that thing legit or not, that ad, that campaign, that doll? Are they winking at us going, yeah, we know this is the white elephant, or no? Grandma's going to love this because she loves Donald Trump. Steve, your thoughts. Who is the intended audience for this?
You said you saw it on Fox?
Yeah.
Boy, oh boy.
It's a real, well, I guess that tips it, doesn't it? Then you know.
Or maybe there's some big joke that they're preparing to unveil on the day after Flag Day or something, that they're made in China or China.
I think they're giving it, I think the intended audience is super patriots. You know, people
who want
to
call it Trumpy Bear.
Well, it's a teddy bear. What are you going to do? By the way, I was on stage with Teddy Roosevelt and a guy on Saturday. Thank you for coming to the Elgin Community College if you were there. And if not, we'll share little clippets maybe on Saturday and going forward when appropriate. In fact, I'll share a clip with you in just a second because one of the guys at our Teddy Roosevelt conversation stood up with the teddy bear in his hand and then doing a kind of ventriloquist thing. He said, "Hello, Mr. Roosevelt. I'm this little bear, and I wonder what you wanted to say to me." Stuff like that. I'm like, oh, no. But it turns out it was a good question, and the answer was really good. And the answer was really funny in a minute. Somebody asked Roosevelt about the teddy bear connection to him. And he started to tell this story about a bear hunt they went on. And they couldn't find a bear until...
I was set on getting a bear. Eventually I found a she-bear that was sleeping. And he clubbed her on the head with his pistol. And he tied her to a tree. And then I came riding up an hour or so later and they said, "Well, Mr. President, you may now shoot your bear." I said, "No, that's not sport. You unleash that bear. It is not sporting to kill an animal that has been clubbed and tied up." So they released it. A cartoonist by the name of Clifford Berryman produced an image of this, and he has it, me standing in indignation with my rifle, and there's a little cute little bear there, and it says, the caption is, "Drawing the Line in Mississippi." And it's all about borders and lynching and so on, but it's also about that moment. And so on the basis of that, it was such a popular cartoon that for the rest of my presidency, Berryman, in every one of his cartoons, would put a little iconic bear at the corner. This became a kind of a brand. And so I received a note from a Brooklyn toy store owner who said, "Mr. President, my wife and I are designing a line of cloth animals, giraffes and elephants and so on. We're thinking of creating a bear, and we'd like to call it a teddy bear in your honor." And I wrote back and said, "Be my guest, I don't think this fad will take off."
So that's, there's your teddy bear story from Teddy Roosevelt himself. About the Trumpy bear, 619 just texted, "It's a joke." But 773 said, "Oh no, they've been selling those on TV for 2 years. And 847 texted in and said, "Oh, they're real because my wife bought me one because I couldn't believe that commercial." 269 said, Kimmel did a great Trumpy Bear and Kellyanne Conway bit last night. And from 708, from a veteran who proudly volunteered, I find Trumpy Bear disgusting. I'm a former GOP member. This is John Williams. It's 136 on WGN. By the way, Steve, just a couple more text messages about that Amazon audio from Alexa. I know if we say that, it sets off people's machines, so I'm not going to say it. But, in fact, Elif, can you just play a clip from that for us, the Alexa audio? She's busy screening a call. Just for a second, play the beginning of that, Elif.
Hello, Chicago. Sorry about the HQ2 rejection. But if it's any consolation, you were the second city we chose. Get it? It's funny because one of your nicknames is the second city, and that's also the name of the comedy institution in your city. Ha 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 ha. Comedy. Speaking of...
See, and it goes on like that.
So I bet all the cities weren't told they were number two. It was a second city joke.
Okay, fair enough. But all the other cities got their version of that.
Many of them did, yeah.
What a bad idea!
I don't know. People like little Easter eggs like that.
John, it's stupid to have HQ2 in New York and Virginia. Wouldn't you want a headquarters in a central city of the U.S. like Chicago? I think the reason you want it in Virginia and New York is, first of all, you have four senators representing your interest rather than two. And I don't know what the political makeup is of those states or the power is of those committees that those senators sit on. But I totally believe that it was part of a political play.
Well, they've got a big presence outside D.C. I don't think that's a big surprise.
John, we should raise Amazon's real estate taxes and then see how funny that is. Ha, ha, ha. Hey, John, here's a joke for Amazon. I'm just reading text. I just canceled the $40 order that I was going to put on Amazon, and instead I'm going to buy it at a retail shop. Ha, ha, ha. The list of texts goes on. So there was a story in the New York Times about these fires in California. Have you watched some of the videos of people driving through?
Yeah, it's amazing.
It looks like one of those zombie movies, you know, where everything is just desolate and cars are burnt out and there's no sign of life and there's just smoldering logs and houses. It looks like Walking Dead. I mean, and it's weird because I watched a video today and a guy's just driving through the neighborhood for a few miles. I mean, the video went 3-4 minutes, and it's just absolutely otherworldly, the landscape that he was showing. Cars that are just shells, some of them driven off onto the side of the road, some of them parked in driveways, just completely incinerated in houses. And then, by the way, sometimes something that seems to have somehow miraculously escaped, but mostly just absolute desolation. And there's conversations out there about the forest management in California. And how did this come to be? The New York Times quotes a Dr. Chad Hansen of the John Muir Project on this topic. And we reached out to him to answer a couple of basic questions you and I may have. Dr. Hansen, it's John Williams. You're on WGN in Chicago. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. So that's my description of it. How do you describe the fire and what you've seen so far?
Well, I think your description is right on the money with regard to the incredibly severe impact on the town of Paradise. The majority of the homes in that town were burned down, and the level of devastation is really hard for a lot of people to comprehend. Obviously, dozens of lives were lost. And, you know, for me, this just underscores what myself and a lot of other scientists have been saying about this issue, which is that we need to fundamentally shift our thinking from this outdated 20th century notion that we should be suppressing fires in remote backcountry areas and doing these logging projects in deep in the forest, far from homes, and that somehow that's going to protect communities. Because what the science is telling us, and what this horrific example of what happened in the campfire in Paradise is telling us, is that we have to focus our attention and our resources on protecting homes from wildland fire. And we know we can do that well. What the research is telling us is that if we apply fire safe principles to houses and help people do that, and help people do what we call defensible space within 100 feet of homes, just basically pruning small trees and lower limbs on mature trees, removing most of the shrubs and grasses. If we do that, then over 90% of homes will survive wildland fires, even big, intense ones. And in many cases where this has really been done effectively, over 99% of homes are surviving fires. We just saw that, for example, in the La Tuna fire last year in Los Angeles County. And so we know we can do this effectively. But when the president of the United States says this is a forest management issue, and what we need to do, supposedly, is roll back environmental laws and basically raid our national forests and other forest lands and open up to even more intensive logging from the logging industry, that is going to make things a lot worse, because it's not only going to damage habitat, but it's going to destroy a lot of communities, because it diverts attention and resources away from where it could be focused, which is protecting homes.
But the president wasn't specific when he lobbed those two tweets out there saying, shame on them, we should withhold funds, they're not doing a good job with forestry management. And I wondered if, in fact, he wasn't suggesting what you first said, that we need to prune trees and shrub away from homes 100 feet. Maybe that's not forestry management, but if we did that, you think that this sort of desolation that we're seeing wouldn't be happening, right?
That's right. We're not going to get to 100% home protection. I'm not sure it's possible, but we are seeing examples in big, intense fires where we're seeing over 99% of the homes survive fires.
Yeah.
Real examples in recent fires in California and elsewhere. So we know we can do this. Now, the reason I say that the president was talking about doing intensive logging out in the forest and not, pruning lower limbs and small trees next to houses is because this is the second time that he's made a comment like this. And also his interior secretary, Zinke, made a comment along these lines as well, basically pushing this mid-20th century notion about logging deep in the forest and somehow that's going to stop fire. Now, here's the great irony of this, bitter irony, actually, is that my colleagues and I did the most comprehensive analysis ever conducted on this issue. And what we found is that forests with the fewest environmental protections and the most logging actually burn the most intensely. So everything the president is proposing is actually going to not only damage forests and increase fire intensity, but it's going to basically put homes and lives at more risk. And in fact, what we saw in the town of Paradise, in the campfire, that fire blew through an area that had been intensively logged on both public and private lands for years before this fire occurred.
Hmm.
And it went through that area so fast that people didn't have time to evacuate.
Are these kinds of fires inevitable because of climate change? Or, I don't know, are these topics related?
They are related. Climate change is certainly a factor. Rising temperatures from climate change, drought cycles. We've always had droughts, but they can be made worse by climate change. Certainly rising temperatures have a role to play. And all those things can increase fire behavior. But what's important to understand is that we need to have totally separate conversations about the impacts of wildland fire on communities, which is always a catastrophe whenever a life is lost or a home is burned, versus what fire is doing out in wildlands, in forests and oak woodlands. And there it's a completely different outcome, because the reality is that study after study, my own research and many of my colleagues, what we're finding is that we actually have less fire now in our forests than we did historically. And there's really no debate about that scientifically. So, it's not a disaster when fire occurs in the forest, but it's always a disaster if fire affects a town and if lives are lost.
I get your point on that. I was in Colorado visiting my brother and family the other day, just a few weeks ago, in fact, and we went for a hike through the woods in the Rockies there. They have a cabin up northwest of Denver. Anyway, as I was walking through this forest for the first time, I've been in that kind of environment, and maybe it was somewhat similar to what they have in California. I was amazed at how much dead wood there is everywhere. Old trees, some of them dry, some of them not so, but just amazed at how much brush and trees there were in the forest. I always thought of forests as a bunch of trees living and standing, but over years and years and years, I guess some of them fall. And I thought about and as you go through these cabins in these neighborhoods, you'll see piles and piles or stacks of logs and sticks and woods that people have collected. But it just seems to be like fighting the tide. I wondered, how can you ever, if a fire came through here, these people are toast. You know what I mean?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, this is one of the things I love about my field. It's kind of like opposite world. So many of the things we're learning are counterintuitive. At least they seem so at first. And one of those things is that, first of all, when you have patches of trees that are killed either by drought and these native beetle species called bark beetles, or by patches of fire where it burns more intensely. Those areas of dead trees are actually an incredibly important habitat type. We call it snag forest habitat. And it turns out that many different wildlife species have evolved to depend on dead trees. Many different insect species have evolved to depend on dead trees. And a lot of the wildlife species eat those insects. Woodpeckers create nest cavities in the dead trees because they're softer than live trees. And so dozens of species of birds and small mammals depend on those dead trees. In a way, it's kind of the cornerstone of the whole forest ecosystem. So what we're learning is that a forest is not just live trees. A forest ecosystem, to be healthy ecologically, has to have a lot of dead trees and down logs. One of the other things that we're learning, and there's a bunch of research on this, is that areas with a lot of dead trees in the forest do not burn more intensely than forests with few or no dead trees. You would think that that doesn't make any sense at all, because it seems like, well, if you have dead, dry wood, it's going to burn more intensely. But the way I explain it to people is it's like a campfire. If you've ever built a campfire, you know you don't put a big log on the fire and stick a match to it and expect it to burn. It's not going to happen. You put kindling on, dry leaves and needles and little twigs, and eventually the fire gets going. You put something bigger on. Well, you know, a dead tree in the forest is just the same. You know, pretty quickly after that tree dies, those dead needles fall on the ground and they decay into soil, and the small twigs fall and decay, and it's kind of like a big log just standing in the forest. There's actually not that much to carry the flames.
So the advice, I'll let you go on this. This is very helpful, Doctor, but it would be stop worrying about the forest, if you will, that is those logging solutions, and just more focus the attention on where the homes themselves are. And if you cleared away the kindling, if you will, by even 100 feet, you think much of this disaster would not take place.
That's absolutely right, and that's what the evidence shows in study after study. And the other thing that's important about this, and the reason why we have to focus on homes, is that the majority of the fires where homes are being lost and lives are being lost are not even in forests. They're in grasslands and chaparral, you know, shrub habitat. They're in oak woodlands.
Well, but if I may, so listen to this. 269 just texted in, and they said, but how will pruning trees and shrubs help when 70-mile-an-hour winds are blowing these burning embers onto your house roof? So I believe that speaks to just exactly what you were getting at. The winds are going to carry the flame anyway, right?
Yeah, exactly. Here's an example. Last fall, a house my wife and I own in a place called Cago Canyon, adjacent to the Angeles National Forest in Southern California, a fire came through called the Creeks Fire, and it was driven by 65-mile-an-hour winds, very, very low humidity, high temperatures, you know, the most extreme fire weather you can imagine.
Yeah.
That fire, in that community, everyone takes defensible space really seriously. Everybody takes fire safe principles on the home very, very seriously. There's a few exceptions, but not many. And, you know, in Los Angeles County, these things are actually enforced annually. People come around, they inspect, they make sure you do your defensible space work. If you don't do it, they'll do it for you and bill you. That's the way it works. It's not a question. It's something that happens. That fire came through the community, and 95% of the houses survived, including our house. It was driven by winds just like that, 65, sometimes over 70 miles an hour, wind gusts, extreme fire weather, and that was the result. So we know we can do this effectively, because the fact is that when you're talking about a really narrow zone right around the houses, you can actually maintain that every single year. You can remove the pine needles and the leaves from the forest floor, rake them up in the twigs. You can prune lower branches and small trees and shrubs. You can mow and cut grasses and haul that away. And, you know, if you do that and you make sure you've got a fire-resistant roof and you don't have, you know, exterior vents that allow embers to get sucked in, you know, you have those right. Ember-proof vents on the house, then your house is going to survive almost every single time. And, you know, it's something we just need to think about and pay attention to those examples because, frankly, you know, homes and lives hang in the balance.
Dr. Chad Hansen from the John Muir Project. Fascinating. And, boy, that answered the question I had. And for some of our listeners, too, I may call you again as these fires continue to burn, Doctor. But thanks for your help today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
We are convening.
Here's John Williams.
A meeting of the Susan Orlean Fan Club. This is John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We're here till 3.
Lord have mercy.
Saturdays, remember, we're on from 10 a.m. until 12 noon on all social media. Look for me. I'm WGN King John. On the one. President and CNN are going at it, and they're going to sue each other. We'll talk about that after 2:30. But in this half hour, let's talk about the library book. It is the latest by Susan Orlean. She wrote, among others, The Orchid Thief. The library book is a really vibrant philosophy book about words and books and the hub that libraries still are. The thread that ties all of these ideas together in this book is the April 1986 fire at the Los Angeles Public Library that consumed or damaged thousands of irreplaceable items and documents and over a million books. Imagine that. And quite possibly the fire was started by an odd, now deceased character named Harry Peake. Orlean sets out to discover the truth in this case and along the way shares many truths of her own. And she tells us about libraries, particularly the Central Library of Los Angeles. She meets really fun, eccentric people along the way. This will be a better movie than Adaptation, which was a movie about the making of a movie based on one of her other books, The Orchid Thief. But the story is meditative, too. Libraries, she says, remind her of her mom. And while the power of the written word is great, she worries that we are all doomed to being forgotten. But, she says, if something you learn or observe or imagine can be set down and saved, and if you can see your life reflected in previous lives and can imagine it reflected in subsequent ones, you can begin to discover order and harmony. You know that you are part of a larger story that has shape and purpose, a tangible, familiar past, and a constantly refreshed future. We are all whispering in a tin can on a string. But we are heard, so we whisper the message into the next tin can and the next string. Writing a book, she says, just like building a library, is an act of sheer defiance. It is a declaration that you believe in the persistence of memory. I don't even need to interview you. That's just too good.
Oh, thank you.
Welcome to the studio. Welcome to the show. Welcome back to Chicago.
Yeah, well, I'm thrilled to be here. If you would warm it up a little bit for me, I'd be even more thrilled.
Yeah, it's going to get worse before it gets better. I got news for you.
Well, I'm ashamed as an Ohioan that I've gone so soft that I find this nearly intolerable.
Because you live in California now.
It got to me, yep. And
in fact, so what's your take, speaking of books burning, what's your take on the fires in California? What are you hearing out there?
I've been following it with a mixture of dread and hope. It sounds like they're starting to contain it, but it's really scary. It's when you're living there, you're really aware of the sense of fire ready to kind of leap out at any moment. And it's very, very scary and really sad to see the number of people who are killed or losing their homes. I'm not sure how we're going to get out of this.
Fire in the case of the library book wasn't that kind of fire. It was probably set inside by an arsonist, and people think it's this Harry Peake guy. How did you discover this story? Why did you decide to tell this one?
It was a pure accident that I even heard about the fire because I knew nothing about it. I wasn't living in L.A. at the time, but I would have expected that I would have heard about it at some point. This was the largest library fire in American history, so it was a significant event. I only heard about it because I was being given a tour of the library one day, and I had just moved to Los Angeles. The person giving the tour pulled a book off the shelf and took a deep whiff off of the book and said to me, you know, you can still smell the smoke in some of them. And I had no idea what he was talking about. And he said, from the fire, from the big fire. And I said, what fire? And he said, the big fire in 86. It shut the library down for 7 years. The minute I heard that, I knew I was going to write about it and dove in.
The reason a lot of us hadn't heard about it was because it coincided with, in the same news cycle, something else.
Right. When I went and looked at the New York Times to see what was going on that day, the banner headline, and I'm misquoting, but it was something to the effect of Soviets deny meltdown at Chernobyl nuclear reactor. So it was the same day as Chernobyl.
So we had a fire in a library. Meanwhile, the whole planet might have gone up.
Right. I mean, they were competing disasters. And the fact that life as we know it seemed potentially threatened, by Chernobyl meant that the story about the library fire did get covered, but it was shoved way back in the newspaper.
What was lost? What was in that library?
Well, it was a big collection. They had over 2 million books, and some of what was lost out of the 400,000 books that were completely destroyed, they had the only patent collection west of the Mississippi. They lost all of the fiction from A through L. They lost all of their science books, all magazines. I mean, it just was an enormous array. They had the biggest collection of books about cooking in the country, and those were all destroyed.
Including 6 guides to cooking with insects. And that includes the classic Butterflies in My Stomach.
You have to find a little humor in the middle of this. And it really was amazing what they lost.
Well, but so I'll just quote you to you again, because that's what this book reminds you of. If you haven't been in a library in a while, what great repositories they still are. 4,000 documentary films, census records back to 1790, theater programs of every play produced in Los Angeles since 1880, telephone directories for every single American city with a population over 10,000. Some of these things obviously could be replaced, in fact, are on shelves elsewhere, but then some of them are clearly not.
Yeah, and certainly some of the more unusual collections, like these phone directories from such a huge number of cities, those probably couldn't be replaced. And, you know, when we think about rare books, we're thinking about valuable Shakespeare folios and the kinds of things that rare book collectors might trade. But when a library has, for instance, yearbooks of every local school dating back to the beginning of the school's founding, that's the kind of thing that is truly irreplaceable. Yeah. They just can't be found and assembled again.
And organized, right. Like somebody's probably got the car manual from their car, but they had every one from cars dating back 100 years.
Exactly.
They had all of the manuals. You could look up Dad's old car and read about it.
And you don't just go to a website and click a button and replace what has really been a collection built over time.
Well, had this stuff been all digitized?
No, this was in 1986. Digitization was still very much in its earliest stages, if even. And so most of that was not recorded in any digital way.
And if it was if it was a recording or a movie, then you can't save that. But you could. Those things are digitized as well. 500 collectible dolls from around the world over this century. Those weren't digitized.
Right.
Those are tangible things that got lost as well.
Yeah. And I mean, the libraries have lots of stuff that isn't text.
That's the thing that I learned in your book, too. And it's not just the collections, it's the activities, the things that libraries do now. I mean, they really are community centers. And I've thought that, I don't know what I thought of libraries, but I thought of a lot of people who are sometimes homeless or don't have the means to find shelter or pay for a book. And so is that a place I want to go? Do you know what I mean?
Right.
We talk about who goes to libraries these days.
Well, I think that there's no question every urban library in this country has a large percentage of people who are homeless who are using libraries. But increasingly, and actually I find this a very wonderful statistic, which is that visits to libraries are going up and people are using them more and more. They're doing all sorts of programming and events and literacy training and business seminars and book clubs. And what libraries are finding is that they really are community centers.
Well, and in the case of Los Angeles, maybe this might be true about Chicago, too. They don't completely divorce themselves of some of those responsibilities to the less fortunate. They have programs for those people. They know that people are going to go there and house themselves for a day. And as long as they don't smell too much, they're going to allow them in.
Yeah. And in fact, a lot of libraries, I was in Madison yesterday and they were telling me that the Red Cross and different social service agencies have office hours in the library because people have finally said, you know, homeless people gather here. Why don't we do intake? LA does this every month. They do intake for all the social service agencies.
At the library.
And the thought is, well, this is where the people are. Let's bring the services here and get people engaged with services they need.
So how did the library burn down?
Well, that's a question that I spent 6 years digging into and trying to figure out whether Harry Peek, the person who was arrested for it, had actually done it or not. I can't give it away, or I won't give it away. I could give it away, but there are a lot of questions still, and it remains unresolved.
Well, the fruit of that, though, is not fruitless. That was why I was so intrigued by your book. It's as much about libraries. It's as much about the word and the permanence of some of these things as it is about this crime. You intersperse it sometimes chapter by chapter, the telling of that and then the telling of the history of this library and all the bizarre and fascinating and wonderful people you meet along the way.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure. I thought, I can't tell the story of the fire without backing up and telling you the history of the library, which was far more amazing and fascinating than I expected.
But who was Harry Peek? Who was this guy?
Well, Harry Peek was a young guy who grew up in an exurb outside of Los Angeles. Handsome, charming. People liked him very much. He was just one of those people who everybody found delightful. He was dreamed of being a movie star. He moved to L.A. He had no particular reason to believe that he had a future in film, but he wanted very badly to be a movie star. And he pictured his life being very glamorous and dramatic. In the meantime, he was parking cars and doing odd jobs.
And telling stories that may not have been true, like, well, I had a drink with Cher, or I'm friends with Burt Reynolds, and maybe he did bump into Burt Reynolds, but you use the word fabulous.
Yes.
To describe him. What's a fabulous?
Well, he was somebody who made fables. And that's a very gentle way of saying that he was a pretty compulsive liar.
To the point where when they're trying to figure out who did this and they question him, he just started telling stuff. And maybe it was true, maybe it wasn't.
And that was the problem, is that he was so notorious for lying and always harmless lies, like saying Burt Reynolds called my mother yesterday to wish her a happy birthday. But he began telling people that he had burned the library down, which either was true, but when someone's an inveterate liar, you also think, well, maybe that's not even true. What's true about what he says?
We'll pick it up here in a minute. The book is called The Library Book. It's about libraries. It's about this story. It's about more than that. It's by Susan Orlean. You remember The Orchid Thief. This is The Library Book.
See? Nice guys.
Hi, I'm Coach Pat Fitzgerald.
Really can.
It's all over.
Finish first.
The Northwestern Wildcats are Big Ten West champions.
Congratulations to the Big Ten West Division champion Northwestern Wildcats.
The Wildcats are going Indy.
But there's still jobs to do. The Cats are in Minnesota to take on the Golden Gophers this Saturday. Andy Mazur has your pregame at 10. Dave Bennett and Ted Albrecht have the kickoff at 11.
Northwestern Wildcat football plays here, 720 WGN.
This story is called The Ugly Truth About Timeshare. If you think you've done your family a favor by buying a timeshare, you need my help. Hello, I'm Chuck McDowell, CEO and founder of Wesley Financial Group. 10 years ago, I started helping folks cancel their timeshare contracts, and in the process started what's now called the timeshare cancellation industry. Timeshare is the only thing that you can buy that you can't tell me how much it's going to cost or when it's going to end. When you buy a timeshare, you give them a blank check to fill out any amount they want for annual maintenance and assessment fees. Sound crazy? The crazy thing is, this never ends. Even when you die, your family's now going to be stuck with this burden. Stop the insanity today. Call my office now. I guarantee if we can't cancel your timeshare contract, you'll pay nothing.
Call for your free information kit, 800-429-3200. That's 800-429-3200, 800-429-3200.
How does a homeowner discover that their insurance policy is outdated? when something breaks and their policy doesn't cover it. 64% of American households are underinsured with outdated coverage. That's what Hippo set out to solve with smart home insurance for the modern home and for up to 25% less. And right now, when you switch to Hippo, they'll give you a smart home starter kit with two smart sensors that help prevent break-ins, water leaks, fires. You'll also get a smart home discount, offering coverage for all the items that run your home, like everything that plugs into a wall, for up to 25% less. It only takes seconds, and all policies are backed by Hippo's top-rated insurance partners with over $200 billion in assets. Go to myhippo.com/WGN and see if you can save up to 25%. Plus, get a smart home starter kit. Go to myhippo.com/WGN today. In 60 seconds, you could save 25%. myhippo.com/WGN.
Are your tires ready for winter? Do you feel like your car is slipping and sliding in the rain or snow? Hurry into Cary Tire and Auto Center, Cary, Illinois, for a free tire evaluation. And while there, save up to $80 on select Hankook winter tires. Now through December 31st. Never halfway. Hankook Tire, where it's always performance season. Stop into Cary Tire and Auto Center in Cary, Illinois, or call 847-639-8866 for all your tire needs.
Now we got to talk on the radio. Fixing the affordable housing crisis in Illinois, could rent control be the solution? Why, some say no way. That's tonight on WGN TV News at 9. What if you could find a way to get forgiveness on the thousands of dollars on your federal student loans and lower your monthly payment in the meantime by half, maybe more? Kaplan Law Firm has spent the last 3 years doing just that for their clients burdened by student loan debt here in the area. Let Kaplan Law Firm help you. Call for a consultation, 312-294-8989, 312-294-8989. Don't waste another dime paying too much for your student loans. Kaplan Law Firm is a debt relief agency helping people file for bankruptcy under the U.S. Bankruptcy Code. Tonight at 6 o'clock at the Harold Washington Library, downtown Chicago, Susan Orlean will be reading from or talking about her book, The Library Book. We're live streaming right now if you're watching us on Instagram. So, hello. Here's a picture of the book. There it is. And you are you reading from the book tonight?
I'm going to read and talk about it.
What's the passage?
A little bit of both.
What's the passage that you favor when you want to give them a taste of the book?
Well, it's a little tricky because the book is about so many different things that whatever I pick feels like I'm leaving something else out. But I read from the beginning a little bit about having recollections of going to the library with my mom.
Yeah.
And how profoundly moving those memories were. And it was a big reason I ended up doing the book, was just thinking, why is going to the library so meaningful? What about it sticks so deeply?
You also confessed that you thought you weren't going to write books anymore because they were just, I don't know if too much work is how you put it, but you alluded to that. And I thought, don't say that.
Well, it makes me feel good to hear that would seem to be a loss. Books are really hard. I was
You worked on this 5 years.
Yeah.
6 years?
Close to six. And I loved it. And at the same time, it's overwhelming.
Well, don't do such a thorough job, for God's sake.
Well, that's, I think, the secret. I've got to do something. And every book I begin by saying, well, this one will be easy.
Easy. Oh,
this
yeah.
is the easy one.
It's about
one.
A library fire, and I live nearby. And,
yeah.
And right out of the gate, you met his, what was it, sister or mom?
Right,
and
right.
So, and she was a coot.
Yeah.
I mean, she was a lot of fun. I have to make a story about her and the couple family members. We'll patch
yeah.
it up, and we're out
yep.
of here by
yep.
June.
Yep. This is exactly what I thought. And then suddenly, it became this fascinating, complex, multifaceted story that I couldn't resist.
And we learned so much about America as we learn about the evolution of libraries and the characters that ran the one in L.A. Ding! Here's a little thing I didn't know until I read your book, that in Atlanta, the library was not open to blacks as recently as 1959.
Yeah.
It was, I presume there was a library for people of color.
Yeah.
But the big library that the white people went to in Atlanta, African Americans could not go to in 1959.
I know. It's absolutely shocking. And there were Atlanta was probably the biggest segregated library that lasted that long. But it's astonishing. And to back up further, the most libraries when they first opened weren't open to women. And also, coincidentally, because we think of libraries as somewhere you go with kids, early on, libraries weren't open to children ever at all. And, you know, kids had to be, they had to be adults to use it.
Fast forward now, there are these multi-purpose internet and also, you know, analog resource centers. And you had a little line in there that kind of got me thinking the other day. You talked about in the Los Angeles Central Library that people there today will be on the internet a lot. I mean, there's computers there. And some of them are looking at pornography and that the librarians allow that as long as it's not illegal pornography.
Right.
Is that true of most libraries?
Yeah, I think the feeling is that if it's legal and not child pornography or something that is prima facie illegal, it's a matter of privacy and freedom of speech that they can look at it. And you can see arguments both ways, but I think librarians' feeling is that they're not censors and they're not going to come and say to you, that's not something good for you to be looking at.
So if you get the New York Times bestseller list, here they are, Sunday's paper yesterday or 2 days ago. There's the top 15, and guess who is at number 12? And moving up to, I think, let's see, one of these lists, you have moved up a notch. I know you care. Yeah, last week you were at 13 on the print hardcover bestsellers.
Yeah.
Now you're at number 12. I got to go. Have they optioned this? Is this going to be a movie?
It's going to be a television series.
Oh, what a great idea!
Yeah, I'm very excited about it.
About the library or about you?
I guess we'll figure that out.
Is this Netflix? Who's doing this?
Well, it'll be on Netflix or HBO. We're not sure what the platform is.
Who's going to play you?
I think I should play me at this point. Unless Meryl Streep is still available.
She did a good job.
Yep, I'll check in with her. But I'm really excited about the adaptation.
6 o'clock tonight, Harold Washington Library, The Library Book, and Susan Orlean. Keep writing. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me. So,
Steve, you know the problem with our guest, don't you?
You won't leave her alone.
Here, Susan Orlean and I are talking on and off the air, so go ahead, Steve.
Well, I'm just watching in the monitor as she keeps getting up and trying to walk away, and then
this is the name of that
you
person.
Bring up another point.
And this is the name of that writer.
Right.
You Google them and you'll connect them.
Okay.
And Elif will help you with me if we need to talk more
okay.
about that.
All right.
Steve, I'm giving her a real good story idea. It's about me and, you know, my life story.
And it's not your book of riddles, is it? Your book of jokes?
It was the Spieler scale of comedy, Steve, and I thought it would be a great idea.
You know, I heard her describing the librarian or the guy, the subject, the fantastical guy or the fabulous guy.
Yeah.
And I keep telling you to watch the Roger Stone documentary. Get me Roger Stone, because this guy who many people think is about to be indicted by Mueller is a lot like that. He's a fabulous guy, like sort of can't help.
I love that word. I you know, I've known people like that who are inveterate liars. They can't help themselves.
Right.
And it's part of their charm and personality, but they're utterly unreliable human beings.
Well, in Stone's case, he's being questioned over things that he said about how in the know he was during the campaign. And when he's pressed by Mueller and others, he says, well, I was just kind of making it up. And he might have been, because that's what he does. No one, you can't tell when the guy's telling the truth.
Brent, as I was telling my wife about this book and this guy, I said, don't you remember that one guy? And I started to describe a person we knew. And she went, oh, yeah, I forgot about
him. It's a type.
But we knew, I know. And I don't know if that's somebody who can help it or not, if they're obnoxious, or if they're endearing, if they're criminal, if they're insane, or if they're just victims of their own, you know, fantasies.
Right.
I don't know what those creatures are, but I've known a couple, and you can't believe 2 seconds of what they're telling you, you know?
That's weird. And because then also, when the time... Are you done yet? Would you please focus on your show?
Okay, well, so anyway, talk to Elif about us getting together afterward, later on if you want more information about that.
So then, when one of these fabulous people, when you try to catch him and you think you've caught him in a lie, they're telling the truth, right?
Right, yes.
And so you just never know.
Well, that's the problem with this book too. I mean, is this guy telling the truth or not? You know, because he did say he did it, but then he says things that you don't think you can believe at all. So that's The Library Book, and that's Susan Orlean, and she's at 6 o'clock.
You have such a crush.
The Harold Washington Library. Are you talking to her or to me?
I'm talking to you.
Okay, I didn't know. I wasn't sure.
It's endearing.
Yeah. CNN is suing the president, or the president is suing CNN? Where are we on
CNN is suing the president. CNN and Jim Acosta are suing the president. I think there's six people, defendants named.
I don't like what they're doing if they're keeping Jim Acosta out of the White House press briefings. I'm not sure if I agree that CNN and Jim Acosta have a case, right? CNN is not being denied access. There's a whole host of people that can still get in there. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so I was talking to a friend of mine who's a media ethics expert, and I said, who controls that room?
A lot of demand for that job.
Who knew? You know, there you are, toiling away in obscurity as a media ethicist, like anybody gives a rip about that. And then, Donald Trump becomes president, and suddenly media and politics and ethics are in the crosshairs. And I don't know how to feel about this. I don't like what they did, but I'm not sure who controls that room. Should the White House and the president and Secret Service, say, have authority over who gets in and who gets to speak and
well,
in what
order? Think they do. I mean, they decide who gets the... No, I mean, I'm not saying in this case, but in general, they decide who gets the credential, I think. But I mean, it's interesting to see if they can force the White House to prove that they did this for cause. You know, I don't think it's a good idea. It's not a practice to support that the president will kick out the reporters who he doesn't like. You know, that shouldn't be the president's role either.
You know, it's funny because all you have to do is never call on him again, right?
Right.
Like, they didn't have to do this. Even if what Acosta did, you know, let's face it, he didn't assault that intern.
Again,
there was no physical contact for anybody ever to worry about.
And the president said the next day that you know, he implied that wasn't a fact.
Yeah, that didn't bother him that much
right.
either. Right, right. But that maybe buries him, right? Because at least the out was, well, you broke
beat up
protocol.
On a little girl. Yeah,
I know,
right?
You can't pummel that young lady. So we had to do it. Trump goes, no, that wasn't it. Well, then what was it? Well, the implication is I don't like him.
He's been mean to me or rude
right.
to me.
Right. So then just think, dude. And by the way, Al, if you're going to get our next guest, right, all he's got to do then is never call on Jim Acosta again. He would vanish into obscurity. You don't have to call on him. There's hundreds of reporters. Some of them are from Brazil. You know what I mean? They're just from all over the world. You know what he doesn't do that often, though? Props to Donald Trump for this. Oh my gosh, what is John going to say? He doesn't always go to Fox. He doesn't feature them. It's not always somebody from the Fabulous Five or whatever they got there. It's it seems to me like he
probably calls on Fox at every briefing, just like he calls on CNN and ABC.
CBS,
yeah, right.
You think he does?
I bet he does, but there's, you know.
He doesn't strike me as favoring them. He doesn't say, and by the way, here's the great Fox News. You guys want to know how to do it? Talk to these guys.
Right.
He doesn't do that. You know, I don't see Sarah Sanders even doing that. Jane Kirtley is with something called the Scylla Center, and she's talked to us about this sort of thing before. It's at the University of Minnesota. Hi, Jane. You're on WGN again. How are you?
Terrific, John. Thanks.
What do you do? What is your job?
Well, I have a long, convoluted history, but the short version is my current job is that I run a center at the University of Minnesota called the Scylla Center for the Study of Media Ethics and Law, and we have important programming on issues involving the intersection of media law and media ethics. I also teach here full-time at the University of Minnesota, but before all that, I was a lawyer, I was a journalist, and I ran an organization called the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press for 14 years in Washington, D.C.
Well, that makes you the single most perfect guest in the history of the world for this topic then today, doesn't it?
Probably.
What do you make of the lawsuit from CNN and Acosta to six people, including the president?
I was waiting to see if CNN was going to file this suit. You probably know and may have mentioned that Penn International, the writers group, has also sued President Trump a couple of weeks ago because of what they claim is his retaliation against news organizations and others for coverage that he doesn't like. I had actually thought that maybe Acosta would piggyback onto that case, but instead he's decided to go it alone. And I think there is probably a statutory regulatory basis for his claim that he was improperly denied or his credential, or rather had his press pass pulled, because there's a very specific set of procedures that the Secret Service and the White House are supposed to go to through before they deny somebody a press pass, and it doesn't appear that that happened.
Oh.
So without even reaching the First Amendment, he may have a claim just based on that.
Or the Fifth, but that's a boring way to do it. You're telling me this is just a procedural thing? That might be the crux of it?
Well, what I can tell you is that courts hate to decide constitutional questions if they can avoid doing so. And what I'm saying is if they've got a regulatory way to do this, any court I know would be happy to do it like that.
Yeah, but
certainly,
I mean, go ahead, Jay.
I was just going to say, certainly making the First Amendment and Fifth Amendment arguments makes it sound a lot more compelling. And, you know, I do think there's a First Amendment issue here, because there is precedent out there that says that government officials cannot deny journalists access to, you know, generally constituted press conferences based on the reporter's questions, point of view, ideology, et cetera. And under the Secret Service regulations, you can really only deny somebody a press pass, assuming they work for a news organization, if you can show that they would be a threat to the president. I don't think that that could be demonstrated here.
There's case law or there's history that says that you can't deny press credentials to somebody just because of what they've written or said in the past?
In the case of the White House, yes, but it actually exists in some other jurisdictions as well. There was a case quite a number of years ago in New Orleans involving a sheriff who was very angry with the reporters from the local newspaper, the Times-Picayune, and he said, you know, I don't want you at my press conference because I don't like the way you cover me. And the court said you cannot deny him access because you don't like the kinds of questions he asks or the kinds of story he writes. As long as he fits the general criteria for admission, whatever those may be, you can't discriminate him against him based on viewpoint.
Well, I guess that's encouraging. I mean, is the thrust of that, you know, it's you're working for the people, these are representatives of the people, these members of the press, and since the governmental officials are, you know, tax-supported, blah, 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 then any more than you could keep me from walking into a park, you can't kick a journalist out of the press briefing room. Is that what's happening there?
It is, as long as, again, your criteria are, you know, content and viewpoint neutral. If a reporter goes in there and starts throwing things around or yelling or something like that in a way that disrupts the rest of the conference, you might have grounds to exclude them.
Oh.
But this is not kicking somebody out of a particular meeting. This is pulling his press pass, presumably permanently. And so that basically means that although CNN apparently has a number of other credentialed journalists, if the one they want to send in is Jim Acosta, he can't be kept out simply because Trump doesn't like him or doesn't like the questions that he asked.
Yeah, but maybe he did breach that protocol. You said if he's kicking and causing a ruckus or a storm, maybe his behavior, let's forget for a moment about how he touched the intern, but simply focus on the fact that he wouldn't yield the microphone and seemed to be belligerent. You saw that press conference. Do you think that there was cause for that? I mean, could they make that case?
Well, I don't think that they really can. And the reason I say that is because, although, again, somebody doesn't have a right to be disruptive, I think that this would be a very close question. You know, Jim Acosta and the president have wrangled before, and we've seen that the president doesn't seem to like to answer the questions that are put to him by him and some other members of the press corps. I'm not saying it would be an impossible case to make, but given the nature of the encounter as it actually occurred, not as it was edited by InfoWars, I don't think anybody could argue that he actually assaulted the intern in this case.
One of our texters listeners just called in and told producer Elif, Acosta does not have a constitutional right to be heard. Comment on that.
This isn't really about his independent constitutional rights to be heard. This is a question to get kind of administrative law focused on you. This is a question of the protocols that the White House itself has set up governing how these press conferences are conducted. And, you know, they have rules. I mean, you know, you have to be sitting in your chair, things like that. And those are reasonable rules, probably, and as long as they're applied uniformly across the board, there's no issue. But what's going on here is that Acosta is, at least arguably, being singled out specifically because Donald Trump doesn't like his questions. And what that means is that he is basically saying, I don't want you in here because I don't like the types of questions you write, I don't like or ask, I don't like the kinds of broadcasts you do. They don't, they, they run counter to the narrative. I want to share.
Right.
I want to control it. That's what this is all about. And I think the concern, and I've seen several commenters saying this, that if this is allowed to kind of just go on as if it's okay for people to get tossed overboard because the president doesn't like their questions, it's not going to stop with Jim Acosta. There will be other reporters that will also have their credentials pulled.
So while this might be handled at an administrative level, I see your point. If it did come to a constitutional argument, you're suggesting that the president really should not or maybe does not have the right to keep him out of the press corps because of the broadcast that he does. That would be wrong.
It's retaliatory based on viewpoint or content, and that essentially is prohibited under the First Amendment when we're talking about a government actor like the president.
Hmm. I wonder what happens in a lawsuit like this, then.
I think in a normal world, what we would see would be there would be a settlement. But I think it's very hard to predict what this particular White House will do. If they decide to dig in their heels, we could have a very interesting case here. As I understand it, what CNN is basically asking for is for a court to order the president to restore the press pass. I can't imagine that he would relish that, so my guess is that it could be just settled outside of the court. But if not, it could become a full-fledged lawsuit. I sort of hope not, because to me, although this is important in terms of the principle that's involved here, I think it is really a distraction from the fundamental questions about what the press should be doing in these press conferences and the kind of questions that they're putting to the president and the kind of answers that I think he ought to be giving in terms of being candid, and responsive to the questions.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, like some of our texters are saying things like 773 here says, Acosta doesn't question, he dictates. There are plenty of us who don't like Acosta's behavior. There's plenty of you who don't like Acosta's politics. And I understand that. I understand the sort of respect that members of the media are not showing to the White House. Never mind if Donald Trump himself does that. That's not the point here. But that maybe doesn't change the first point you've made. Jane, I'll let you close on this, and that is you feel like there's just a procedural thing. This could be handled as a measure of protocol, and in that case, the White House would lose.
I'm a big believer in following, you know, what they call due process, but what I would say is simply a matter of administrative law. They've got procedures in place. In a case called Cheryl versus Knight, the Secret Service was told to create these protocols. They need to follow them. There's no evidence they did it here. You don't even have to get into the First Amendment question, I think, for Acosta to prevail on that argument.
Enroll your children in Jane Kirtley's classes at the University of Minnesota. She's at the Scylla Center in their law school there. It's nice to hear your voice, Jane. Thank you for your time. I'm WGN King John on social media. There you'll see lots of pictures of us at the game last night. We were with David Hochberg and some of our listeners at the Bulls game. Thank you for that, Mr. Hochberg. That teenager that you're raising or watching or helping could use some guidance, and you could use some help. If there's a drug problem, an alcohol problem, if there was trauma in the family and it's affected that young person, if there's an ongoing mental health issue, where do you turn? Do this. Click on yellowbrickprogram.com. Yellow Brick is in Evanston. They guide young people and their families. They help those kids launch at yellowbrickprogram.com. That website's very good, very comprehensive. I'm telling you, if you are looking for help, there's a tab there that you'll click on and go, wow, these people know what they're talking about. One for substance abuse, one for crisis management, and they stress early intervention. Do this. I want you to click through yellowbrickprogram.com now and follow the Yellow Brick Road to Recovery. Yellowbrickprogram.com. We do a daily web poll question at WGNradio.com. Here's our news click today.
High school students in Baraboo raised their arms in a Nazi-like salute. This was A, innocent. They are waving. B, intentional but naive. C, intentional and hateful.
What do you say? We're going to talk about that tomorrow. Vote with your mouse at WGNradio.com. Ro Khan and Anna DeVlantis. Hi, guys.
Hello, John.
What's going on?
We've got a lot coming up here. We're going to be talking about Amazon for sure, because we lost the race, but did we win in the end? We'll have to see what happens now.
Did you hear the audio of the Alexa making fun of us?
She was making fun of us?
Okay, I'll make sure you guys have that.
Okay. She had some jokes about Nanny Nanny, Virginia City, and Queens are better than you?
Yes.
Hmm.
Some real knee slappers.
Great.
Some cheap shots. Well, it's interesting because, you know, you already see in New York now, they've got the city, you know, this new Congresswoman Ocasio, who is saying that it's a bad deal that they cut. She's trying to get New York legislature to take some of the tax breaks and give it to the schools and help to, you know, repair crumbling infrastructure. So there's a bit of that going on as well.
If they want to work the system, don't they know this is the place to go? You come to Chicago, Jack, and we'll take care of you.
I got that thing, you know.
We got a guy.
I got a guy. What do you mean? Hey, Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, come over here.
What, I got your, you want to go, you know, especially if you went over by West Side, go by Taylor Street.
I got two words for you.
We'll hook
front,
you up.
Front row, okay? What do you like? What do you want to see?
Hamilton. We got Hamilton next couple weeks. You like that? You like Hamilton's?
I can get you the Bulls. In fact, I think you could play for the Bulls. What do you want? What do you want?
You could kick for the Bears if you want to, for sure.
Now we're doing it, damn it.
We shouldn't do that.
All right. Nice. I'm going to call this to a halt.
Bye.